ගරු ගජේන්ද්‍ර කුමාර් පොන්නම්පලම් මන්ත්‍රීතුමා, ඔබතුමාට විනාඩි 10ක කාලයක් ලැබෙනවා.
I thank you honorable presiding member. I rise today to speak on the proposed amendments to the Financial Transactions Reporting Act, the Prevention of Money Laundering Act, and the Convention on the Suppression of Terrorist Financing Act. At the outset, honorable member, let me make one point absolutely clear. Sri Lanka has an obligation to protect the integrity of its financial system and to comply with the standards of the Financial Action Task Force, or FATF. Failure to do so risks grey listing, diminished investor confidence, higher borrowing costs, and further economic hardships for the people. But, Honourable Speaker, that is not the issue before us today. The issue before this House is whether these bills are genuinely implementing the FATF standards, or whether FATF is being used as a justification for granting powers that FATF itself neither requires nor recommends. That distinction is fundamental. The government repeatedly tells us that these measures are necessary because FATF demands them. Yet when one examines FATF Recommendation 8, one discovers something very different. FATF does not require governments to treat every civil society organization as a potential security threat. It does not recommend blanket restrictions. It does not advocate arbitrary surveillance or necessary interference. With legitimate organizations. Instead, FATF repeatedly states that measures must be targeted, proportionate, and risk-based. It recognizes that many non-profit organizations are inherently low risk and encourages governments to work with civil society, not against it. Yet what do we see in Sri Lanka? We see organizations, particularly those working in the north and the east, and those engaged in human rights work, subjected to surveillance, repeated questioning by security agencies, obstacles in opening bank accounts, and increasing difficulty receiving legitimate foreign funding. The government's own risk assessment reportedly concludes that the overall terrorist financing risk within non-profit sector is low to medium, yet organizations engaged in human rights work continue to face heightened security without objective evidence that they have engaged in terrorist financing or money laundering. That is not evidence-based regulation. It is regulation based on suspicion. The consequences are already being felt. Nearly 70% of civil society organizations reported difficulties receiving foreign funding. Half experienced difficulties opening bank accounts. Projects have been delayed. Staff salaries have gone unpaid. Humanitarian programs have been disrupted. Communities have been denied services they desperately need. But, Honourable Member, these bills go much further. Their impact will be not confined to civil society organizations. They will affect ordinary citizens, small businesses, journalists, and every person who depends upon the rule of law to protect them from the arbitrary state power. Consider the small money exchange business in PETA. Under the proposed amendments, the owner who may face penalties of up to 100 million rupees for failing to comply with transaction thresholds that are not even contained in the Act itself, but will be determined later through rules issued by the head of the Financial Intelligence Unit. Parliament is being asked to approve offences today while leaving the substance of the law to be determined tomorrow through administrative directions. That is not how legislation should be enacted in a constitutional democracy. Consider a rural microfinance institution serving women-led households and small farmers. Many of its customers may lack complete documentation because of poverty or natural disasters. Faced with uncertain legal obligations, the institution may simply refuse loans to those who need them most rather than risk severe penalties. The result is that the burden of regulatory uncertainty falls not on criminals, but on the poorest members of society. Consider a civil society organization that receives funding from an international donor to rebuild a school. If the transfer is delayed because it is automatically treated with suspicion, construction is postponed, contractors remain unpaid, teachers cannot be compensated, and vulnerable children lose access to education. Once again, those who suffer are not criminals, but ordinary citizens. Consider the investigative journalist who receives a confidential document exposing financial misconduct. Under these bills, Honourable Member, investigations may obtain access to her computer and mobile phone through an ex parte application, without giving her an opportunity to protect confidential sources or invoke journalistic privilege. The inevitable consequence is to discourage whistleblowers from exposing corruption and to weaken press freedom and public accountability. Or consider the father whose bank accounts are frozen while he is merely under investigation. He has not been convicted. He may not even have been charged. Yet his family cannot pay rent, purchase food, obtain medicine, or meet school expenses. To access his own money, he must first embark upon lengthy, expensive legal proceedings while depriving of the very resources needed to defend himself. Honourable Presiding Member, these examples illustrate a common theme. The bills before us significantly expand executive discretion while reducing meaningful safeguards. They permit broader administrative powers. They diminish judicial oversight. They widen information sharing. They permit intrusive investigative techniques. They extend powers to freeze financial assets. And they increasingly replace clear statutory standards with future rules and administrative directions. The government presents these measures as unavoidable because FATF requires them. But where does FATF require Parliament to surrender its legislative responsibility? Where does FATF require broad executive discretion without adequate judicial oversight? Where does FATF require restrictions that are neither targeted nor proportionate? The answer is simple, it does not. Honourable Presiding Member, this debate is therefore about far more than anti-money laundering legislation. It is about preserving the constitutional balance between effective law enforcement and individual liberty. It is about ensuring that the fight against financial crime is conducted within the framework of the rule of law. It is about ensuring that extraordinary powers remain subject to extraordinary safeguards. History teaches us that powers granted in the name of the security rarely remain confined to their original purpose. Today, these powers may be directed against civil society organizations. Tomorrow, they may be directed against journalists. The day after, they may be directed against business. Ultimately, every citizen becomes vulnerable when executive directions replaces judicial oversight and due process. That is why this House must examine these bills with utmost care. No one in this House is asking that Sri Lanka abandon FATF compliance. On the contrary, we should fully comply with FATF. But let us comply with FATF as FATF itself intended, through evidence-based, proportionate and risk-based regulation. Let us not invoke FATF as a justification for expanding executive power beyond what FATF itself requires. National security and constitutional liberty are not competing values. A democratic state worthy of the name protects both. I therefore urge this House to reconsider these bills to ensure that they faithfully reflect FATF's own standards, strengthen rather than weaken judicial oversight, and preserve the constitutional rights and democratic freedoms that Parliament has a solemn duty to protect. I thank you, sir.
Bomestuti obutmata.